Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, a special two-hour election preview continues. We pick up where we left off last week and talk to Fresno mayoral candidate Lee Brand. We also look at some important local races from Congress right down to school board on today's show. We'll also talk to journalist Charles Fishman, who's author of the book The Big Thirst. He'll be in Bakersfield later this week. And we'll find out why the youth orchestras of Fresno will be sharing the stage with the Youth Orchestra LA at the Soroyan Theater this weekend. Plus a preview of tonight's Zocalo Public Square event, are Central California residents giving up on government? Right now, though, we turn our attention to a potential big change that's looming in the way that one county deals with protecting its most vulnerable residents. Fresno County is looking at shifting how social service workers respond to reports of child abuse. It's part of a national trend that Kern County has already embraced. FM 89's Jeffrey Hess reports the local inspiration comes from an unlikely place.
In Huron, a remote farming town of about 8,000 people, you can find two trailers that house the Westside Family Preservation Services Center, run by Jean Marie Karras McManus. It's a constant buzz of people, young and old, looking to connect. Sometimes the question is as simple as, can my husband come here to study? Sometimes it's more severe, like women fleeing an abusive husband or handling reports of neglected children. The center is also ground zero for what the county calls differential response, which is a fancy way of saying intervening with a family before suspected child abuse or neglect begins. Karras McManus believes you can prevent child abuse and neglect by addressing some of the root causes, such as poverty, food insecurity, and lack of social support. And she works hard to create an environment where clients feel comfortable asking for help.
If you have a culture of love, and if a person can feel your respect, and if a person genuinely can feel that you are not there because you think you're going to fix them, no matter how horrific the situation is, then you can do it.
The goal is to step in at the first reports of suspected at-risk children and refer them to programs like this one.
And so we work to strengthen the families so that the children can live in a safe and stable environment. So we have parenting classes, we have victims of violence classes, we have women's support groups, we organize trips for the families.
This program is small, but could soon be the model for the rest of the county. The Fresno County Department of Social Services is proposing shifting roughly $3 million toward differential response. They believe by partnering with community groups like this one, they can head off child abuse before severe damage is done.
So before there's the trauma to the child, they can access and hopefully seek help or get preventative services so the children aren't traumatized.
Delfino Niera is the director of the department and driving force behind changing how the county responds to suspected child abuse. Niera has been on the job for about 2 years. And says he wants to put more focus on borderline cases of suspected child abuse and neglect, rather than waiting until the county is legally required to intervene. He believes this could have the effect of reducing total cases overall.
The biggest intervention in a family is a government intervention, and we are the government. And we need to be respectful of that, we need to be careful of that, and at all times we need to work with our partners and see if somebody else can work with the family, because it is very intrusive. It is, once it happens, you can't pull back.
To be clear, the county is required to investigate all claims of child abuse. When they're found to be legit, or are in other words substantiated, officials must respond. Differential response is about the other cases that don't require legal response, but where children might be at risk. To do that, the county is considering funding a total of 7 sites like the one in Huron. The idea is not revolutionary or even new. Other counties have been moving toward this approach for years. Kern County started differential response more than 10 years ago. According to Jamie Stewart with the Kern County Network for Children, they've seen a 35% decline in substantiated child abuse cases since 2008. She says the program is working.
So instead of the families just not receiving any kind of a response in terms of supportive services until the next subsequent referral comes down the road, maybe, we're going out saying we understand that there, someone in the community is concerned about the safety or well-being of your child and would like to offer you support.
She says the program has also helped produce a decline in the number of kids in foster care. While it seems to have promise, the challenge for Fresno County is funding it. NERA is recommending reallocating $3 million in money the department is already spending on other services. Part of that money currently goes to CASA, or Court-Appointed Special Advocates. They represent foster kids in court. Executive Director Nathan Lee says if the county follows through on this plan, it could mean as much as a 25% reduction in funds for CASA. Lee says that puts CASA in a tough spot. How do you balance the needs of the most desperate children versus helping early on to keep them out of that cycle?
No doubt that there's going to be good value that comes from it. Our concern is that CASA is a community asset, and if we lose that level of funding, it will result in the erosion of our ability to do our mission. And I think our community and the foster children who are in the greatest need will suffer for it.
Lee is also quick to say they share the department's goal of reducing child abuse, but doesn't want to see the funds come at CASA's expense. Jean Marie Karras McManus, who runs the site in Huron, also has a word of warning for the county. The centers must be part of the fabric of the community and listen to people without being condescending.
If you've come to help me, stay away. But if your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us work together. And if you have any other approach than that, if you're coming to deliver services, it's going to fail.
The Department of Social Services is still very early on in the process of establishing the sites and differential response approach. Because of how the contracts work, the real action probably won't start in earnest until next summer. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
The streets of Fresno can be dangerous, and not just to drivers and bicyclists, but also pedestrians. Following a trio of fatal accidents last week, more pedestrians have died this year than in all of 2015, and they've made up more than half of all traffic-related deaths in the city. But as FM89's Carrie Klein reports, advocates and a new city plan aim to make the city safer.
It's 2:30 p.m. on a Tuesday, and in this part of southeast Fresno, that means one thing. School's out.
Come on!
Kids are excited, but it's a time of anxiety for some parents, like Jessica Zuniga. She's a volunteer crossing guard at Lean Elementary School in southeast Fresno.
You gonna cross? Okay, wait a minute, okay?
She shakes her head as a black SUV roars past a blinking school zone sign.
We're going to make sure that the kids are safe walking across the street because there's a lot of crazy drivers.
She has three young kids. Two of them are here at Lane. She and a handful of parents began volunteering for crosswalk duty around a year ago.
Well, I see a lot of parents that park close to the crosswalk and they like to honk a lot instead of getting down for their kids. So that's one because the kids just jet out and, you know, they're like, oh, mom's here or whoever, you know, and they just run across.
She has reason to worry. People do get injured and killed walking the roads in Fresno. 14 pedestrians have been killed so far this year, a number that's already higher than in all of 2015.
I don't think I'll ever let my kids walk to school. My son asks all the time, but I'm one of those worried parents. I walk them, but, you know, they're right next to me. I don't let them go ahead.
There's no single reason why people get hit. Distracted drivers or a lack of crosswalks and sidewalks. And of course, some pedestrians, like excited kids, just don't follow the rules. But whatever the reason, there's someone out there trying to fix it, including Fresno itself, with a new city plan. On average, 13 to 14 pedestrians are killed on the roads each year in Fresno. Compared to our population, that's pretty high, and we score low on national rankings of pedestrian safety. On the other hand, when you consider the number of miles driven each day in Fresno, we actually rank as one of the safer for pedestrians. Truly, though, your safety in Fresno depends on where you are. Pedestrian collisions happen most often in the northwest, central, and southern parts of the city. Geno Beba Islas is the director of Cultiva la Salud, a nonprofit group that promotes community health in Fresno County. She says many of those areas are old and were developed at a time when cars were the priority.
So things like having wide sidewalks, having crosswalks, street lighting to help pedestrians be visible, bike lanes really weren't in the ideas at that time.
Right at the edge of those high collision zones is Lane Elementary School and Jessica Zuniga's crosswalk. Student safety here is one of Cultiva La Salud's priorities, and the group works with the city to solve problems with infrastructure. But Isla says there's another element to road safety Fresno hasn't fully tackled yet, and that's outreach to both drivers and pedestrians.
I think if there is any neglect that I could say on the city's part is that they haven't invested in as much of the non-infrastructure type resources as are needed. And so by that, it does allude to that education that is needed. You know, how are we messaging and communicating about sharing the road?
Jill Gormley is a traffic engineer with the city of Fresno, and she agrees.
Can we do better on infrastructure? Yes, we can always do better in those areas. But I think education would make it safer for pedestrians.
The city already engages in some education and outreach, including billboards and bus placards about pedestrians and a Fresno police program that sends officers into classrooms to talk about road safety. But now the city has just drafted its active transportation plan, which aims to make it easier and safer to get around Fresno without a car. The plan does emphasize infrastructure, but it also recommends social media outreach, better driver training, and a national safety program called Safe Routes to School. A UC Berkeley evaluation recommended that program to the city back in 2009.
We've worked a lot with different neighborhoods, different groups, and we've gotten a lot of feedback up until this point. This plan is really based on a lot of community input and feedback.
A draft of the active transportation plan is available for public comment until November 10th. It'll be finalized by the new year, but it may still take years to be implemented. In the meantime, advocates and volunteers are doing their part on the ground so that maybe in the not too distant future, parents like Zuniga will feel safer waving goodbye to their kids at the front door. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Water has always been a major issue here in Central California, perhaps never more so than right now, as the state is in its ongoing drought. It's also the topic of a new series in Kern County, One Book, One Bakersfield, One Kern. This year, the entire community is focused on reading the book The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water by journalist Charles Fishman, who joins us now on the phone. Charles, welcome to Valley Edition.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
I'm
looking forward to my visit to Bakersfield and Kern County in person in not too many hours.
Yeah, Charles will be at the Accardo Center at CSUB at 7 p.m. Thursday night for a discussion and book signing that really caps off the month-long series of events that have been going on in Kern County, focusing on water and the book that Charles wrote. Before we actually get started talking about some specific issues, how did you go about coming up to write this book? Where did it, what was its genesis, so to speak?
I got interested in water through the world of bottled water, to be quite honest. I stumbled on a bottle of Fiji water while my family and I were on vacation in Miami, Florida, where I grew up. And this was 4 or 5 years ago. Fiji water was actually the brainchild of some folks in California, believe it or not. Maybe that's not surprising. But we had never seen Fiji water before. And my wife cracked open the bottle that was in our hotel room and pronounced it absolutely fabulous. I couldn't believe that the water had actually come from Fiji. And I took the empty water bottle back to my office. We lived in Philadelphia then. We live in Washington, D.C. now. And when I got back to my office, I discovered two really important things. The water in the Fiji water bottle comes to the United States of America from Fiji. And Fiji is 9,000 miles away. And on Fiji, at that time, 5 years ago, 53% of the people in the country didn't have clean, safe drinking water. So we were getting a product that is absolutely unnecessary to anybody in the United States. There's only whoever needs a bottle of Fiji water. from a place where the basic water need wasn't even being met. We were getting something. It's easier to get clean, safe drinking water in the United States from Fiji than it is in Fiji. Well, that just seemed kind of ridiculous. And so I was inspired by that empty Fiji water bottle to go try and understand the American obsession with bottled water. And that is, in fact, what I did. I made the significant sacrifice of traveling to Fiji. Some journalists put everything at risk by reporting from Syria. Some put everything at risk by going to Fiji. if anybody ever offers to send you to Fiji, go ahead and go. And I saw where Fiji water came from, and I actually went to Poland Spring, Maine, which is where a lot of bottled water on the east coast of the United States comes from. And believe it or not, I went to San Pellegrino, Italy, to see where San Pellegrino water comes from. And the story I wrote really lit people up. We got a lot of response from people who were sort of amazed at how much culture and effort there was in bottled water. And having done that story, I thought, you know, if you write about water by telling the human story behind the water, you know, you get people's attention. And so the book is obviously about the whole water system that we're entangled in. It's not about bottled water at all. But bottled water was my path in.
We're still in this drought here in California. We hope that some end is in sight. But has the drought changed people's thinking? We certainly know it's changed policy in some ways. In some ways, we've already seen some rollbacks of restrictions from the state. But has it changed fundamentally the way people think about water as you're talking about here?
Sure. It's changed some attitudes permanently. For 4 or 5 years, you saw a lot of really encouraging signs. When Californians were asked to conserve water, to use less water, to change their habits, overall, you know, at homes and businesses, utility water, you know, water supplied in pipes through cities, Californians cut their water use 20%. They did that while the economy of California continued to grow much faster than the economy in the U.S. as a whole. California created lots of new jobs, more new jobs than any other state in the country. So you cut your water use while you continue to grow and thrive economically and create economic opportunities. So you were able to make it through that first 5 years of the drought, continue to be economically vibrant. You weren't sort of dying of thirst. But as soon as the restrictions were lifted, people went back to their old habits and the conservation dropped. I just was looking at the numbers for Bakersfield this summer. In the city of Bakersfield, the average per person use of water was 235 gallons a day. Last summer, it was 204. So everybody in the city on average is using 30 more gallons a day of water this summer than last summer. And I don't think anybody was at a loss last summer. So the habits drift back depending on how the conversation is framed and how attitudes change. But the real key is to put in place policies that help people change their behavior permanently. You know, one of the places things haven't changed nearly enough is agriculture. There are cities in California that have done brilliantly. San Francisco has had a very steady conservation regime in place and a changing culture in place. Now, San Francisco is very different than Bakersfield and Kern County. People don't have large yards, but here are the numbers. The consumption in San Francisco is whatever, 60 or 70 gallons per person a day. The consumption in Bakersfield, Kern County is 250 gallons per person per day. So just compare that. So I think there's lots of progress to be made. I think the most impressive thing that's come out of the drought is that people who run water systems are even more serious about making change so that even if the drought ends, you all say when the drought ends, but there's a possibility that this is a new climate. The drought hasn't lasted 5 years. You've had 3 or 4 normal years in the last 12. Well, if you look at a long time frame, 3 or 4 wet years out of 12 means that the dry year is the normal year, and the wet year is what's unusual, not the other way around. But water managers around the state are doing really, really impressive things. You know, Los Angeles is getting ready to capture its stormwater, clean it, and reuse it. In Kern County, you all use a lot of water. You all use twice per person what the national average is. But you do something most communities don't. Almost every gallon of water that goes down a drain in Kern County is recycled in some way, is captured and reused a second time, either on a farm or for outdoor watering for things like athletic fields and parks, or it's cleaned and put back in the aquifer that you all are relying on underneath Bakersfield and Kern County. So that kind of reuse is really, really impressive. All the stormwater that falls in Kern County is captured and reused. It's cleaned and put back down in the aquifer. In much of California, the stormwater is captured and sent straight to the ocean. They literally do everything they can to collect it so they can throw it away. So there are all communities in California are paying attention. People are sort of making, you know, episodic progress depending on what fits their culture. What I'm most impressed with is the water managers of California from one end of the state to the other don't think that the wet years are going to be the normal years anymore. They think you all are entering an era when the new lower level of consumption is going to have to be the normal level of consumption. And if I had to pick between the people and the water managers, I actually wouldn't pick. I want you both to get the right attitude. But I'm glad the water managers don't have their heads in the ground anymore. I'm glad that they are trying to provide leadership for their communities. And Californians have proven that they can do better, and so they just need, they're going to need a lot of reminders that the drought years may actually be the normal years.
You mentioned per capita use of water in individual homes, but the individual water footprint of every Californian, every Bakersfield resident, every American citizen is a lot more than just what we consume in our individual home. You write about that in your book as well. That extends also to the food we eat. And that, are we making progress on educating people about their true water usage beyond just domestic use?
No, we're making very modest progress. Look, something like 55-60% of the fruits and vegetables produced in the United States come from California. I live in Washington, D.C., and we happen to be a family that likes salad. We like fruits and vegetables. When we buy strawberries, when we buy lettuce, when we buy spinach, when we buy baby carrots, which are the headquarters of baby carrots is there in Kern County, the price of those things is exactly the same as it was in 2015 and 2014 and 2013 and 2012, if not a little cheaper. So you guys who produce more than half the fruits and vegetables are going through you're in year 6 of the worst drought in settled human history in California, and yet the product you produce, the price hasn't changed. Now, we're used to the price of gasoline going up and down. The price of gasoline in the space of just a couple years went from $20 a barrel to $100 a barrel. And at the pump, it went from, whatever, $1.75 to $4.25. That caused a lot of pain, but it also caused people to buy cars that used gasoline more smartly. It caused a lot of businesses that relied on petroleum products to find ways of doing their work while either using less fuel or making their use of that fuel much more efficient. And now the price has come back down. The price has come back down because conservation has tamped down U.S. demand for petroleum products. It's come down because natural gas is on the market and other reasons as well. There's no price signal to water And I think that's really, really sad. No one on the East Coast, no one in Ohio or Texas has any appreciation for the drought based on the price of a bag of baby carrots. And so I don't think we're doing a good job of explaining to people two things: how much water it takes to run the kind of agricultural economy that California produces for us. The agricultural industry in Kern County, I just looked at these numbers, uses literally 10 times the amount of water that the residential and commercial part of Kern County uses. And so water really undergirds the whole economy of Kern County. And you know what? Farmers want to grow good food. They want to make a little bit of money. And they are actually much more aware of water than ordinary people. If we want them to use that water more smartly, if we want them to learn to grow the same amount of carrots with less water, if we want them to shift from growing carrots to growing almonds, which use a lot of water but produce a lot more revenue given the amount of water they use, we've got to help farmers figure out how to do that. I think we want to be able to raise our own food, and I think we want to do that in the most water-smart way. I don't think we can impose the burden of making farming more water efficient exclusively on the farmers. I think we need to help farmers see what the smart ways of growing food with less water are, and we may need to spend some of our own money as a society and even as consumers to help move that production to smarter ways. So I think we are really, really insulated from how our food gets produced. We're really insulated from how much water a bag of carrots requires, and we subsidize that water. That's why you can get 3 pounds of carrots for $1.99 in Washington that came from California. You couldn't mail 3 pounds of carrots back to California for $1.99. So the fact that it's in your grocery store and everybody makes a living along the way is kind of amazing. And so we need to modernize the relationship between water and farming, and if that costs money, we as a society need to be willing to help out.
At the same time, California is undergoing this major drought and a lot of discussion about conservation. The state is also working on habitat restoration, and the State Water Board has recently announced proposals to significantly increase the amount of natural flow in a number of California rivers. You have people ranging from agriculture interests to even the city of San Francisco raising concerns about what that would do to their operations. The city of San Francisco even says that it would have a huge economic impact on the city if they were forced to see their water supplies on the Tuolumne River greatly reduced. And again, this is to improve natural habitat in the state, threatened species, endangered species in many of these rivers. How should conservation and the environment fit together at the same time?
Well, look, this is a hugely complicated issue and a hugely emotional issue with good reason. People don't want to be pitted against small fish or small birds or frogs. And at the same time, scientists, conservationists, people who live in the community rightly say, is it really necessary to extinguish whole species so that we can grow kale? So in any individual community in California with any watershed, there's lots of powerful arguments on both sides. I take a step back and look at it this way. We need to organize our modern advanced economy and society in such a way that we don't require other species to go extinct so we can use water. I don't think anybody would disagree with that in the big picture. We should be able to run California, we should be able to run Arizona, we should be able to run coastal Virginia in ways that allow the most advanced human civilization, that allow us to have good jobs and big factories and reasonable farms while not putting other species literally out of existence, not exterminating them. The problem is that wasn't a criteria, that wasn't a thought when human beings started using water, when Californians started allocating water rights to people. And now in a drought, it turns out there's not enough water for everybody. There's not the environment needs a certain amount of water to be functional. Rivers, wildlife, farmers are entitled to a certain amount of water. They need a certain amount of water to be functional. And if you've over-allocated, if you've overdrawn the water bank account, so to speak, then you end up with conflict and you end up with competition. My baseline is the goal should be to organize society so that the environment has enough water. There is no water separate from human existence. The idea that you're trying to save a snail darter at the expense of human beings, that's the wrong way of confronting the issue. Now, if that's the situation you're in, it's hard to persuade people that that's not what's going on. It's either me, the farmer, or that little endangered species, and I don't want to sacrifice my family for the endangered species. And again, I think there's an issue of transition. There's an issue of saying we need to buffer this. We need the salmon. The environment needs the salmon. We human beings are part of the environment too. We need to move to a system where the environment has enough water and where there's enough left over to do what we need to do. If that means we need to reduce human use, it may mean, for instance, that you have to buy back water rights from farmers who've had them for years, and you have to pay them for those water rights in a really reasonable way. You know, when we build the highway, all the land in America is allocated. You build a highway, you condemn land and take it from people so you can build the highway, but you pay them for their homes or their businesses or their farms, and you pay them an amount that's reasonable based on the value of the highway and the value of their land, the importance of both those things. And it may be that what we have to do is, as an example, buy back water rights from people so that we provide enough of a cushion for the environment and so that we say to people, we're not going to punish you because we're changing the rules now. That, by the way, is exactly what they did in Australia. Australians had a drought just like the drought in California. It lasted 10 years, covered the entire country, not just one state. And Australia physically is as big as the United States. And as part of that, they realized how damaging their water use patterns were to the natural sources of water that everybody relies on. And they put in place a real program to buy water rights and return them to the environment. In Australia, that program was, I think, almost 100% voluntary. If you wanted to hang on to your water rights and keep doing what you were doing, okay, fine. But if you were willing to put your water rights up for sale and sell them back to the government, then the government would buy them from you and give that water permanently back to the environment. So I think what California needs is a kind of big picture look, and then you need to make sure that in moving to a better future, you bridge the people who would otherwise be harmed to that future, so you don't impose the burden on individual farmers or individual communities.
We've been talking with journalist Charles Fishman today on Valley Edition. He's the author of the book, The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. He's speaking Thursday night at 7 p.m. at the Accardo Center at CSUB. It's part of the series of events, the community-wide read known as One Book, One Bakersfield, One Kern, talking about the future of water in California and beyond. Charles Fishman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, guys. See you soon.
And we'll be back with more of Valley Edition in this two-hour election special in just a moment. Our conversation with Fresno mayoral candidate Lee Brand is to come, as well as our preview of this weekend's Youth Orchestra of LA and Youth Orchestras of Fresno concert at the Sorollan Theater. Straight ahead on Valley Edition.
I'm Audie Cornish, host of NPR's All Things Considered. And at NPR, our investigative reporters spend months uncovering stories that take you behind the headlines and around the world. But the most exciting part of our investigations? What happens after you hear them? These investigations aren't just stories. They inspire change. Take our coverage of how the American Red Cross spent the $500 million it received to rebuild Haiti after the earthquake. The story exposed a stunning lack of accountability and mismanagement of resources.
5 years later, the total number of new homes the Red Cross has built in Haiti is six.
In another series, our reporters found that coal mines in the U.S. aren't paying their penalty fees and aren't getting any safer.
Those mines with delinquent fines, they're more dangerous than the mines that do pay, with an average injury rate 50% higher.
As a direct result of those stories, senators in Congress introduced a mine safety bill last April. And one award-winning series investigated race-based experiments of mustard gas. They were conducted by the U.S. military during World War II.
Documents show the military scientists thought people with darker skin might be more resistant to chemical weapons. And they tested that theory on Black and Puerto Rican soldiers.
All of these projects got the attention of government officials and prompted further action. When you give to this station, you're not just funding interesting stories. You're helping us uncover new information that truly makes a difference in people's lives. Help us tell these important stories. Contribute to this station today. And thanks.
Listening to a special two-hour Valley Edition election preview. I'm Joe Moore. A little later on in our program, we'll talk with Fresno State political science professor Jeff Cummins and talk about some local races that are generating a lot of attention, including the big congressional contest between David Valadao and Emilio Huerta in the 21st Congressional District from Fresno to Kern Counties. Also some local contests, public safety taxes everywhere from Kings County to Madera, Visalia and beyond, and some school board races that are generating some controversy as well. Right now, though, we turn to the Fresno mayor's race. Last week, we talked to current Fresno County supervisor and mayoral candidate Henry Perea. This week, it's his opponent, current city council member Lee Brand. For the last 7.5 years, Brand has been a key policy force on the city council, passing a number of fiscal management acts that some have credited with helping the city right its financial ship. But does he have what it takes to be mayor? A few days ago, we had a chance to sit down and talk about his vision for the city. Lee, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for being here.
I want to start out. I was talking to some friends the other day, people who are pretty well connected in local business and what happens at City Hall. And the issue came up of just what a Lee Brand administration would look like. Would it be Swearingen 3.0? And the consensus was that it wouldn't. But that makes me ask you, how would your administration be different when you move into office January 5th?
That's always a natural question. She's endorsed me and I've been there for 8 years. But every person has a different leadership style. We may have the same overall goals, but it's how we achieve those goals, how the people we choose to be on our management team and to implement the goals. So in certain respects, they'll be familiar, continue on the efforts of revitalization in downtown. But I'm going to probably have a larger focus on economic development citywide. I really want to top priorities is to generate thousands of jobs for citizens of Fresno and really make sure this is an even distribution, that it covers all of Fresno, not just part of Fresno.
So what's the best way to do that? The mayor came into office with experience with the Regional Jobs Initiative, and that was all about trying to grow local businesses more than trying to attract businesses from outside of the area with incentives and things to move to Fresno and set up shop here. She's put a lot of effort into that. Would you continue on with that? What's your thoughts on the best way to try to develop the economic growth?
Well, first of all, I have 38 years of successful business experience as a job creator. I run a company that employs over 100 people, very diversified. As a contractor, I've pulled permits in several cities in California. I know the plan check process. And I wrote the Economic Expansion Act, and I did, in fact, collaborate with the mayor on that. And it's, you know, and it's that represents over 1 year of detailed research into best practices. And what it shows is that, you know, most businesses, over 70-80%, have 20 or fewer employees in California and nationally. So the answer is usually in your own backyard in terms of how do you expand your employment base. So that's one, it's incubating new businesses here. Two is expanding existing business. And three, of course, is having the appeal to bring in like a Nordstrom's to Fresno. But there's a lot of missed opportunities, I think, here locally, one primarily being in exporting. There's tremendous potential that I think a lot of local businesses here don't really understand. And I think I heard a statistic that La Tapatia, a local plant, is selling more tortillas in India than any other company. And that just illustrates the global market out there. And it's also, we need to a better connection with foreign investors in terms of acquisitions, mergers, financing, strategic alliances. There's a tremendous amount of opportunity that we need to tap into. One of my main three goals in my administration. The first 100 days is to launch the Economic Expansion Act with a goal over 4 years or 8 years, again, of creating thousands of jobs and really transforming this city from what it's always been for many years, this generational poverty, high unemployment, high crime. I want to forever change that model. So when I finish my final 100 days, we're going to say Fresno was consistently under 10% unemployment. Fresno wages were on the rise. People from all facets of life in Fresno had opportunities to get good jobs, pay for health care, they can raise families, and they're not always going to the lowest common denominator. There's a great need in this city for affordable housing, yet we always want to just put the bar lower. I want to raise the bar. So hopefully in the future, fewer and fewer people need affordable housing. They can afford market rate housing.
I want to talk about affordable housing later, but how specifically do you do that? Is it a problem of the city not having the right land, the city not having enough people in City Hall who have experience on the international import-export thing and mm-hmm. hiring a new economic development director? I mean, what would you specifically do to get there? Because I think most Fresnans would want to see mm-hmm. Unemployment stay below 10% and those sorts
right.
of things.
Well, I'm contemplating, I hate to always put, I'm going to get a commission because there's so many commissions and committees that end up talking for 3 or 4 months, produce report, and report gathers dust in some back warehouse in City Hall.
They have a lot of those.
We have too many of those. But to me, if we did that, I would put private sector experts on this panel, not people that have good intentions, but people who understand business from different facets of business to kind of put the pieces in place to truly make Fresno a business-friendly place. That starts with a permitting plan check process. And every administration coming the last 3 or 4 has always tried to do that. And to a certain extent, they all have been successful. But I think we in the current one now, we've made progress, but there's more progress to be made. And some of that is the culture at City Hall that needs to be dealt with to be more accountable. It's also going to be, removing barriers. For example, one of the main barriers for developing downtown or in a lot of areas of Fresno is infrastructure. So what the mayor has done is getting, $70 million in cap and trade money, is getting the federal and state government to help, us get our fair share. And if we can find the money, and the cap and trade is designed for transformative types of projects that can leverage private sector investment on a $3 or $4 to 1. So if we can take $70 million and find the right investments like an infrastructure and leverage it out 3 or 4 times, we're talking about $250 million invested. That's a huge investment that would elevate the tax base substantially, because there's been some discussion, should that go to this area of town or that area of town? Well, that's going to be a public discussion and ultimately a vote of the council and the mayor. But I think you've got to find a way to strategically place money to leverage it to its maximum ability, and you build up that tax base, and that's essential to eventually addressing a lot of the issues in neighborhoods in terms of streets, and crime and parks and trails.
Lee Brand with us today talking about issues in the Fresno mayor's race. He's one of the candidates on the ballot squaring off against Henry Perea. Your opponent has advocated using some of that cap and trade money for things in southeast, southwest mm-hmm. Fresno. He's even mentioned parks as being one potential benefit. Why is he wrong? And you're advocating spending that money around the high-speed rail station. I seem to recall you being a little skeptical of high-speed rail. Is there a disconnect there?
Well, no. I still have the same overall questions and doubts about the overall business model. But if I'm elected mayor, that decision to bring the high-speed rail forward has been made. My job as the mayor of Fresno is to implement whatever I can do for the maximum benefit of the city of Fresno in terms of jobs, infrastructure. So this is a common sense business approach. I'm not a ideologue, so I'm not going to let that get in my way. But when you look at the different alternatives, for example, investing that in parks, nobody can argue that we don't need parks. There's two problems. One, we have existing parks that need millions of dollars to restore. So we got to find a way to resolve that issue before we start on this great expansion program of new parks. And the problem with investing this kind of money in, say, parks, for example, there's no leverage from the private sector. And my approach is a two-step approach. Is you put the money strategically, whether it's around high-speed rail station or areas that are going to attract a lot of private investment that's going to, you know, leverage it, again, $3 or $4 to one, you're going to greatly elevate the tax base and generate the monies from sales tax, room tax, property tax that will pay for more parks, that will pay for the maintenance of existing parks, that will address issues in Southeast and Southwest, all over the city on curbs, gutters, streetlights. All those things need to be done. But there's got to be a logical, well-rounded business approach to it, simply trying to placate different interest groups. I went to three seminars or three debate forums on the Southwest Fresno on Monday. It was on parks on Tuesday, and on Wednesday it was on downtown. At each one, Henry would promise them a share or a big share of the cap and trade. Well, you can't pander to every group. You can't be everybody can't get everything. There's got to be a fair process, but it's got to be done in the best way that benefits the citizens of Fresno.
You mentioned that your administration would have a more citywide focus than perhaps Mayor Swearengen talking a lot about downtown. You've also talked in the past about how you were initially a downtown skeptic. It took you a few years to get on board the bandwagon the mayor has been driving for some time. What did she say or what did you see that changed your mind?
I think it took about 3 or 4 years to see the progress that was being made. That, you know, and I was a key vote on early on, like in the downtown plan. And as I saw things play out, I saw, you know, the success that Granville had in their building their residential developments. I saw the success of Bitwise and how what they were doing, and I saw other things going on. When we, for example, voted to remove the mall and with all federal and state dollars, make that open street again. When I saw $100 million in investments within 2 years, that's the private sector speaking, saying, we believe this was the right move. We believe there's a lot of potential. Because ultimately, there has to be a market-driven business model that makes it work. And I think the cumulative efforts that she's done, and this is not to talk down anybody, her predecessors, but she put all the pieces together, and she understood, I think, the strategic plan of getting the money together, the high-speed rail station, which is a component, cap and trade, engaging the federal government and help, and working with the private sector, the collective effort, I you can see it nowadays. I go door to door. Believe me, downtown is not a hot topic, but it's all perception. If you go down there now, you're going to see a lot of changes. And I think within 10 years, you're not going to recognize downtown.
As we continue our discussion with Lee Brand, I want to move to an issue that's perhaps been one of the hottest lately, and this is this issue of rental housing in the city, affordable housing, some people call it slumlord housing, and the problem that has been documented many times, most recently, last year, almost a year ago, the individuals live at Somerset Village that were without heat for a good number of weeks there. The city has taken a variety of approaches on this, having a lot of meetings, a lot of groups. The mayor now has come out and said she wants a universal inspection program. You have criticized that. Where is the mayor wrong on this approach?
Well, first of all, I think I understand this problem much better than anybody because I've been 38 years in the industry and a member of the California Apartment Association, which represents, you know, responsible professional ownership. I'm a licensed real estate broker. I'm a certified property manager, and so are most of the companies that manage properties in Fresno. And I know intuitively that there's a small percentage of substandard housing, slumlords, if you will, that simply throwing a shotgun approach out there is not going to solve the problem. The first thing you need to do is you need to have the city improve its record-keeping database software. They can look at obvious things like Somerset Village. There's a lot of smaller units, 1 to 4, that fall through the cracks. So number one is we got to have the software and the record-keeping that can clearly identify where the problems are at. Number two, you need to have a definition of what substandard is. I could talk to five different code enforcement people and get five different standards. So there's got to be a standard definition. My approach would be to actually bifurcate the code enforcement department and have a separate division where the department head has the people working there specifically trained to do inspections and what to look for in the rental housing business. And I think a logical leak may be through the city attorney's office, possibly, because the city attorney is going to be vested with the enforcement. This is setting up in a way that you can specifically have the task force available with the expertise. We also, and over the last year, the city has had about 6 or 7 ordinance changes, including the one we did yesterday, that basically, and I advocated this 6 months ago, of trying to fit the crime with the punishment. In other words, there would be a lady who had a hedge 1 foot too high, would be at a hearing officer based on delays and non-performance and faced $25,000 fines. A guy with a 20-foot hole in the roof, it's the same fine. There's a difference between having your grass too tall and having a hole in your roof. So what we did yesterday is we're going to change the master fee schedule to have everything appropriate. So if your grass is too high, that might be $100. If there's a hole in your roof or there's mold, that might be $1,000. We've did a lot of other things, and we also have to have the resources, have the prosecution of these cases by the city attorney or third-party attorneys. So inspecting every single unit, in my opinion, it would take probably 3 or 4 years, if even that, is not the answer I'd look at. I think a registry down the road may be a solution, but what I've outlined are specific methods that will address the problem, actually get results, because there's just kind of this gut-level, knee-jerk reaction. Everybody wants to have a very safe – nobody wants substandard housing, particularly in the rental housing business. So I think I can outline a detailed plan that's actually going to solve the problem and not simply make a political statement, and we'll come back 2 years later and go, gee, nothing really changed.
Now, your opponent, Mr. Perea, says, as you mentioned, you have ties to the apartment industry. He says those are too close of ties and you should consider recusing yourself. How do you respond to that, and why is that not a problem in your view?
Because I represent the best in the industry. To become a certified property manager, you have to go through a rigorous amount of qualifications and testing to get that level. And I think that, you know, Mr. Perea interviewed with the Apartment Association. Mr. Perea said he opposed universal inspections. Mr. Perea has his donors that are large property owners that are members of the California Apartment Association. So that's a non-issue. It's a thinking issue about, you know, what's the best way to solve the problem. And I believe I've got some specific knowledge, and I've demonstrated time and time again on the council, I've always done my research. I've always come up with very well-thought, effective ways to deal with problems.
You're listening to Valley Public Radio's Valley Edition, a special 2-hour election edition of our program. We're talking with current Fresno City Councilmember Lee Brand, who's running for mayor. Stay with us. We'll be back with more of our conversation with Lee, as well as some key analysis on important local races, including the 21st Congressional District. That's David Valadeo versus Emilio Huerta, a contest that's getting national attention. It's all coming up on Valley Edition, straight ahead. This is KVPR Fresno and KPRX Bakersfield.
My fellow students, my campaign supports more recess every day.
This fall, a lot of campaigns are making big promises.
And instead of math, we'll have video game class.
Only time will tell how many will be kept. But there is one campaign that will keep its promise, to bring you insightful news, enriching classical music and entertainment year-round. We call it Yes on 89. Valley Public Radio's fall membership campaign. We count on your support to keep public radio strong here in the Valley. And even after the votes are counted this fall, our reporters will be there to make sure your representatives do what they say.
If I'm elected student body president, we'll have pizza parties every Friday.
Yeah. Vote yes on FM 89 today with your membership donation at kvpr.org.
I promise to abolish homework.
You're listening to a special 2-hour Valley Edition election preview. I'm Joe Moore with you until 11 today. Stay with us in a little bit. We'll have some more analysis of other local races taking place in Central California, including the hotly contested battle for the 21st Congressional District. Right now, though, we continue our conversation with Fresno mayoral candidate Lee Brand. Speaking of the issue of affordable housing, there's been a lot of pressure from the federal government, from the state on this issue in Fresno, saying the city's not doing enough in this area. HUD a few years ago came into town and really gave the city a scathing review in its use of some housing funds, saying it wasn't doing what it was supposed to do. How would your administration handle that, given the challenges with affordable housing, both in the demand and in the cost? You know, you had the Housing Authority a few years ago build homeless housing near the Pavarello House there at a cost of something around $200,000 a unit. How would a brand administration approach this affordable housing issue, given that there's all this new pressure both from the government and from the community?
Well, it's certainly a serious issue in our community. And I've said this before, it's not only affordable housing. It's, I think Fresno, as a marketplace, is probably some of the cheapest housing in the state of California. I think our bigger problem is low wages. We don't have jobs that pay enough to have people have a living wage and have a decent standard of living. The other problem with affordable housing is the oxymoron. Affordable housing is the most expensive housing you can build because of the way the system works on tax credit properties. You have to have a lot of bells and whistles to be successful in winning tax credits. You're also using prevailing wage, which, you know, I know from my own business, it escalates the cost about 30%. And so maybe at a market level, you can build an apartment unit at $120,000, $130,000 a unit. And affordable housing, you're at $200,000 to $300,000 per unit. So you're really getting half what you could do. But those kind of solutions really are at the federal and state level in terms of how the system works on tax credits. You know, this year the council voted to put a trust fund for housing. And I think the city has not done the best job as far as managing its housing resources. And one of the issues was the Hotel Fresno that I opposed back in 2011. And I identified it as basically having no chance of being successful based on the model that was highly leveraged, and that was part of the problem that was done, written up in that one report by HUD. Since then, of course, they brought in a nonprofit with that knows the ropes, understands tax credit, and puts in the equivalent of 50% plus equity. Then it's a different story. But it's something we need to work on. But something, I'm gonna just make one final point. We're always trying to lower the bar for Fresno. We need more affordable housing, more subsidies. We need to raise the bar. Find a way to give people decent jobs, education, that they can rise from poverty. They can rise out of the housing project, and they can rent a rental unit from a housing, from a free market or a open market. They can buy a house. I want to raise the bar. I want to say at the end of my eight years as a mayor of Fresno, that we dropped our poverty rate substantially, that we found more opportunities for people to get jobs, and that the number of people on public assistance dropped dramatically in the city of Fresno.
The city has an overall budget of about $1 billion, but the general fund is only around a quarter of that. And of that, the police department takes up 57% yet, and the fire department, and the vast, vast majority of the general fund is taken up by public safety. Is that a concern overall? Because I've heard even Mayor Swearengen say, you know, you can't run a city when all of your general fund is being taken up by public safety. Yet at the same time, we see a rise in crime in some cases, fire service, that's another big issue. What would you do when it comes to public safety with the budget? Your opponent says he wants to take off sworn officers who are on desk duty and put them back on the streets. How do you pay for it? How would you pay for the things that you want to do when it comes to public safety?
Well, the reality is right now, we have an authorization for 804 police officers. I started back in 2009. It was about 830. It got as low as probably 695. So we were on the upsurge in terms of the number of police officers. If you look at national ratios, we're one of the lowest. I think we should be at least 1,000 or more to be consistent with other cities our size. But, of course, you know, hiring a police officer is very expensive. It's about $100,000 counting pension costs to hire a police officer. When Mr. Perea says, I'm going to take people off of desk duty, there's not that many to take off. It's been that thin as far as the ranks. I believe we actually need to add more police officers. But in my campaign, I've said we need to have 1,000, which is roughly 200 more. But to do that, it's got to be introduced over time, and it's got to be the same level of logic. You've got to identify a long-term sustainable funding stream. And I could say, in one sense, you know, public safety, that's the cost of doing business. One way to get around that, if you look at the long term, would be to identify and to treat the underlying issue of poverty in Fresno and a quarter of our population that just is in dire straits, low income, limited opportunities. We can find a way to lift those people out of poverty and to generate jobs, to get people to participate in our economy, to have decent paying living wage jobs they can afford families, then I think that will probably deal more with the public safety problem than anything else. I'm also a strong advocate of redeploying our police officers into a community-based policing model where police are in the streets connecting directly to neighbors and neighborhoods and building the trust. And I've advocated a police advisory board that would work in tandem with the police auditor and is implementing this true community-based policing model to improve accountability, to improve transparency, and to truly reconnect our police department and improve the relationship and bridge that relationship with our community and our police. Because every community, in, I believe, in this state and across this nation is almost like a powder keg with a lot of long-term, you know, racial tensions. And I want to be preemptive and try to, you know, to bridge this gap, solve this problem before we become the next Ferguson.
Lee Brand is with us today on Valley Public Radio talking about a lot of the issues that are going before voters and that are issues in the mayoral campaign. He's running against Henry Perea. I had your opponent here last week, and we were talking about his thoughts on a narrative that the mayor, current mayor Ashley Swearengen, has advanced. And she says that so many of Fresno's problems are due to the way it grew over the past 40 or 50 years. Do you subscribe to that idea that sprawl is the root of, not, I don't want to say all evil, but the root of the problem in Fresno? Or is it, what are your thoughts on that?
No, I think sprawl was a big part of why we are in the situation we are today, because you take a model going back into the 1950s, the post-World War II baby boom, and everybody wanting to buy a house in the suburbs and buying a car. And you take the San Joaquin Valley. You know, I remember as a kid, you can look across endless rows of grapevines and fig orchards and fruit trees and a limitless horizon. And that was cheap land. And it was, there was this business model, let's just keep moving out, let's keep moving north. And there was no sinister forces here. There was basically market forces that were unrestrained and unregulated. And I think leaders of the past failed to recognize the long-term trends and cost of urban sprawl. Because there is a cost when you, the further north, when I grew up on McKinsey Street in southeast Fresno by Belmont and Cedar. And when I left by my college years in the late 60s, early 70s, it was already started to decline. People were starting to move out. And as times went by, that is kind of moved. They always use Shaw as the demarcation line for, you know. But what happened is that these properties that are the older areas of Fresno, southeast and southwest, I always use the term underperforming in terms of their values, the businesses that generate sales tax, and overconsuming services like code enforcement, police, and fire. And in addition to the moral obligation of taking care of the community, it had a huge financial impact on the city of Fresno, and it's costing the general fund millions and millions of dollars. And as they built those subdivisions, particularly the ones in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and they had impact fees, but the impact fees would cover maybe a police station. They didn't cover the future cost of paving the streets, the future cost of sidewalks, curbs, and gutters, or the future cost of buying a fire engine or having the staffing for police and fire. And that model didn't work. They've changed that in the last 10 years, what they call the community facility districts, which are more of the district imposing itself, like Copper River. That's a solution for future. And there has to be some sort of balance. You know, there's going to be new development. But I was a part, I was a swing vote, in fact, on the approval of the 2035 general plan, which was a landmark decision. The first time in probably 50 years, the city said, we're going to put an end to the, we're not going to expand the sphere of influence and keep growing into the hinterland, and we're going to focus our efforts now on the inner cities and on the older neighborhoods. And I've walked both north of Shaw and south of Shaw, and we have a lot of work we have to work on south of Shaw.
There's a perception out there amongst some people, and we hear this from listeners. I got a letter a couple of weeks ago from a listener on this very topic. There's a perception that city politics, that City Hall is essentially run by Fresno's development industry. This goes back at least as far as Operation Rezone back in the late 1990s when several city council members were tried and convicted, essentially of bribery, changing their votes on in issues to rezone land with thanks to the influence of developers. I don't think there's any allegations that that is going on right now, but there's still a perception out there amongst some people that development interests control city politics. Certainly developers are a big part of this campaign and financing. Both your campaign and that of your opponent have received significant dollars from developers. Henry has a lot of money coming in from the biggest housing developers. You've got the apartment industry and apartment developers on your side. When someone says something like that, when I get a letter like that, how would you respond to that? Why would that person be wrong?
No, there's two primary powerful forces in Fresno politics for probably the last at least 20 years. And one, of course, are developers, particularly single-family home developers. And two, it's labor unions, and they have a tremendous influence on City Hall. And Mr. Perea is primarily, most of his funding is coming from labor unions and from single-family home developers. I have a few developers. Now, you say property management. Most of the property management donations are not from developers. I mean, Rick Ginder is one who's both an owner, and so is Spencer. But beyond those, these are all people that simply manage properties like I do. I'm not a developer, building new developments out there right now. And if you look at his comments back when he was on the board chair a few years back, and he said, I'm for development of Madera. I was talking about the Fryant Quarter, which would be another urban sprawl between Copper River and Fryant Ranch. It's clear that, his at least his words and his deeds and his voting record has been one that's not supportive of the general plan and infill development and revitalization. We all have a record. I have 8 years on the city council. Henry has 24 years between, school boards, city and county. My campaign pledges, my campaign promises are consistent with my voting record. And I'll challenge that his voting record is different than his promises is on the campaign. For example, we had a downtown forum a few weeks ago and questioned, did you support the PBID, the property-based assessment district? And Henry said, I support it, but he voted twice against it. So again, I supported the PBID. So you got to have an honest, appraisal of where you're going to be, where you've been, and where you want to go. And you can't, please everybody. You can't pander to every group because people are going to pay attention.
We have a few minutes left, a few other things I want to get to with Lee Brand today. With the Better Business Act a few years ago, you were really a force trying to prevent the city making certain deals, incentives. Fresno has a history of this going back all the way to the tortilla factory and then the baseball stadium and all these things, deals to try to accomplish something or build something that would be good for the city. You have a white elephant right now with Celand Arena. I know you've talked about naming rights and all sorts of things like that. But let's say that somebody comes to the city and they say, you know what, we want to bring a hockey team back to Celand Arena. The city even took out bond debt to renovate it for the Falcons, and the Falcons folded up shop just a few weeks after moving into the newly renovated facility. Assuming that somebody came to the city and wanted to make a deal there, how open would you be to making a deal? You made a deal with the Grizzlies to keep them in Chuck Chansey Park. When it comes to Celand or something like that, what's your approach?
Well, let me first say that since I wrote the Better Business Act, the city was acting like a bank. If you're going to act like a bank, you better regulate yourself like a bank and do due diligence, look at financial reports, appraisals, personal guarantees, and so on. I can say proudly that since I wrote that, not one business has came forward asking for money because they shouldn't be. The city should not be involved in those kind of ventures, in my opinion. I did a close examination of the convention center. I was on the Finance and Audit Committee that had been ignored for years and discovered that the city was subsidizing the entire convention center complex by about $8 million a year. Most of that was bond debt that was made by foolish decisions in the past that should have never, when the decision to build Save Mart was a reality back in the late 90s, it forever changed the business model. And what they did, like the hockey team's the best example, to lure the hockey team back from Celand, didn't verify any financials, attendance, where they're at financially. Within half the season, they had spent $4 million on upgrades in the Celand, and they went bankrupt. That's an example of poor decisions. A baseball stadium that was built for $45 million that could have been maybe built for $25 million. That legacy, when you make an error on a bond, it's not a one-time, it's a 30-year error that we're paying $3.5 million a year. So that legacy lives on, and I think what I've done there, and again, that's one of the elements that's in the charter, is prevent these disasters from happening again. And these really failed projects, they rob from the things we need. We, again, parks, streets, police, fire, all that have taken the toll. On the convention center, I actually had a couple hockey teams that wanted to come. And what I established in that review and with the Better Business Act is that we're not going to just take a team and say, oh, God, I get, you know, team A or team B that brings in 2,000 people a game when we know the break-even cost just to keep the doors open is our 3,000 plus. It's not going to work. It's got to, if we were a rich city that could afford to subsidize these kind of things, that's great. Fresno is not a rich city. We've got to be use a business sense. And I think the model that I set up was that any future, whether it's a sports team, big entertainment venues, they've got to pay themselves off. In fact, we adopted the concept of a co-promotion where when certain concerts come there, we look at them, we feel it's worthwhile, we both put our money out. That made the city about $400,000 to $500,000 the first year. That's smart. That's using private sector, you know, intelligence and decision-making at the city level to make sure these unfortunate mistakes aren't made again.
Lee, you're a pretty hands-on guy. When it comes to the city's form of government, though, the city manager actually runs the day-to-day operations. What would you be looking for in a city manager? And would you intend to keep Bruce Rudd around for a while, as Mayor Swearingen did when she took over? She kept Andy Souza on for a number of years, actually, as a holdover from the Autry administration. What would you look for in a city manager? Because they run the show, essentially.
First of all, I think by my circumstance, I'm probably the best prepared person to do this because I've spent 8 years on the council. I know this city and all its problems intimately. I know the solutions. I know the problems. And I know the people. I know I've worked with all these people, those that are good, those that are maybe not so good. And I know Bruce Rudd is going to retire. I'm hopefully I could convince him to stay at least a year to help in the transition. But when that transition comes, and it will come, so I've said the same thing on the chief of police. I want to hire the best and the brightest. I think sometimes you need to, not that I wouldn't look at anybody in-house who may be qualified, because they're certainly welcome and would be considered, but I think we owe it to ourselves as a city to find the best and the brightest. And in my business, when you go from a small two- or three-person office to 100 or 200, you've got to have that ability to let go and to delegate. You've got to have your confidence that you've hired good people, that you can walk away, be on the city council, and know when you're not there that business is being run properly. The same thing applies getting a good city manager, getting department heads. My job won't be to micromanage anything, but get the best people in place. And my job is to look at from the strategic point of view, are we accomplishing our goals? Are we keeping are delivering the services that are necessary? Are we keeping ourselves under budget? And there's going to be some really key roles, a city manager, probably when Jerry Dyer decides to retire, that replacement for Jerry Dyer. So, again, my commitment is to get the best and the brightest wherever they come from.
Lee Brand is running for mayor of Fresno on the November ballot, facing off against Henry Perea. He joined us today. Lee, thank you so much.
Thank you, Joe.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Later tonight, our friends at Zocalo Public Square will come to town to present an event in Fresno which asks a provocative question. Are Valley communities giving up on government? I will be leading the panel discussion for Zocalo and will be joined by Ray Leone of the Valley Leap Program, also the Tulare County Food Bank, Sarah Ramirez, and Fresno State social work researcher Chris Clark. It'll be taking place at Frank's Place, which is a venue as part of the Warner's Theater Complex in downtown Fresno. Lisa Marganelli is writing for Zocalo Public Square, and she's done a number of pieces about health in California, including a couple in the Valley that illustrate this very trend. Lisa, welcome.
Thank you.
I want to ask you about this rideshare program. We hear about rideshare now. We think Uber. We think Lyft. But it turns out that in some small rural farm towns in the Valley, people have been doing this for a long time without the help of any smartphone app. Why is that?
Well, that's really true. They've been doing it because these towns are so far from all of the services. And there's kind of this indigenous homegrown solution, which is that older retired farm workers who may have given people rides while they were working in the fields sort of switch over to giving people rides around town. And one of the people who I interviewed was named Carmen Lopez. She's from Huron. Huron, as you know, is about 50 miles outside of Fresno. So if anybody needs to go to the court or they need to go to a doctor's appointment, they end up needing a ride. And a surprisingly large number of homes or households in Huron actually don't have cars or don't have a driver at home.
Well, how do they connect?
They just know the people around town. You know, Huron has 6,000 people, but it's only about a mile square. So it's like an urban density in the middle of all these giant tomato fields. So everybody knows everybody. They're all connected. And if somebody needs a ride, they call their first person. There's about 8 or 9 riteros, they're called, in the town of Huron. And they'll start with the first person that they are closest to. And then they keep calling through other people. Once I met Carmen, I could understand why she was a big favorite. She's really sort of stylish. She has kind of a snappy, optimistic person. I don't know exactly how old she is. She retired some years ago, but she puts on like a pair of rhinestone sunglasses and gets done up and grabs her purse and takes people on these rides to Children's Hospital, which is, you know, quite far away from Huron. That's more of a 60 or 70 mile drive each way. Or she might take people to dialysis, and that would be closer. And she would, on the way home, she'll stop and take them out to, you know, take people grocery shopping or to get their prescriptions or whatever they need. So it's like a very perfect system. People pay her some money for gas. Some people who have more money will pay for her lunch. And some people will give her an extra 10 or 20 bucks on top of that. It kind of depends. It's very sliding scale. It depends on what she feels people can pay. And she said in the interview, she said, well, it's on them. She doesn't feel like she's being, you know, taken for a ride by anybody who needs the service. It's on them to determine whether or not they need it and how much they can pay.
Certainly getting to the doctor's office is very important, difficult in those rural communities. Why not, though, use a taxi or something like that?
Well, the taxis are really expensive. The taxis usually have to be routed out of Fresno. Sometimes they're routed out of Hanford or somewhere closer, but even so, there isn't a taxi in Huron. So even if they older people in Fresno County can qualify for Measure C funds that will pay some percentage of a taxi ride, but even with the measures, you know, the total cost for a taxi to and from Fresno might be around $200, and people will end up paying, I think, about $75 for that service out of their own pocket. So someone like Carmen, who might charge them, you know, $30 to $40, is much, much cheaper. Also, the fact that she's willing to stop on the way back and take them shopping or whatever. The other thing about Carmen is that if people aren't confident about their English, she'll go in and help them fill out the forms. She's very soothing. She's been through everything. She actually delivered a baby in her minivan once. You can't surprise her. If I were having bad health, I would simply love to have her drive me.
That's sort of the small town story, but you have another piece for Zocalo that tells the story of a program in Fresno that, again, is sort of a do-it-yourself program to a community health problem in need of a solution. This one, though, very different, the Fresno Needle Exchange. We've reported on that program several times on our air here. How did you see that also as an example of this community-supported model of tackling a problem in the world of health?
Well, the Needle Exchange is amazing. It's been going on for 21 or 22 years, and it's run entirely by volunteers. And it's kind of an extraordinary little community down there. It meets in a cul-de-sac for 2 hours every Saturday afternoon. The fact that the volunteers have the Needle Exchange exchanges, I think, 900,000 needles this year. That's just a tremendous amount of biohazard debris to dispose of. You know, they have to buy these special garbage cans to put the used needles in. And then they also are supplying, of course, fresh needles in boxes to people. So it's really, it's an incredible sort of logistics challenge. It's hot. And yet I think it's done really out of caring. I mean, the people who show up at the exchange are just this really broad swath of Fresno's population, and you couldn't possibly sit down and characterize them. And then the people who are manning the exchange or womaning the exchange, you know, have been committed to this for years, and it's just really quite incredible. And there's like a real feeling of sort of caring and community and pride amongst the people. Both who visit and who are volunteers. This is actually working to prevent HIV transmission, to prevent hepatitis transmission, and it's also, there is in Fresno now a syphilis, sort of a very, very high rates of syphilis, and it is sort of spreading through the IV drug community. And the needle exchange is really keeping, you know, is one thing that the community can do to keep that in check.
We're talking with Lisa Marganelli, who writes the Small Science column for Zocalo Public Square. She's the science and humanities editor there. She's written a couple of pieces about the Valley, and both of them deal with homegrown solutions to problems that in many cases are taken on by government. Lisa, why do you think we're seeing these sorts of things here? A, is it unique? And B, why?
Well, it is unique. You don't see this happening, say, in the Bay Area. It might be happening down the Riteros might be happening down near Monterey or somewhere like that, but you don't see it in places that have a lot of resources like the Bay Area. You also see it's you know, the Valley has a lot of family connections, and so people are using those family connections and kind of extending that out to the whole town. So I think that's one thing that's happening. There's a need, and people are using. You know, the bus from Huron takes more than 2 hours, and it only goes once a day, and it comes back once a day. So you'd have to get your appointment in the middle of that. So you can't actually depend upon things like the bus to get to your appointments. So it's another factor here is that there aren't resources. So people have sort of built resources in there to fill in the gap. One of the things that's happening in Huron is that there's a group called Valley Leap, which is working to make electric cars and hybrid electric cars available to the Riteros and to try to sort of standardize it a little bit more and expand it to more people so that they can take some of the pollution out of the equation. But that, again, is really a homegrown effort. It doesn't have a lot of state support at this point. You know, there's lots of interest, but they're really struggling to pull together the resources to do this. And that's not what you see happening in the Bay Area. I mean, in the Bay Area right now is just crawling with Uber and Lyft, or LA is. But you don't. There's really hardly any of that out in the sort of extremes of the Valley. As far as the needle exchange started as a volunteer effort, I think, in San Francisco more than 20 years ago. But it has become part of the sort of the health department's job is to do the needle exchanges. And people can also, in the Bay Area and in L.A., they can go into a local Walgreens and exchange their needles. That, you know, for whatever reason, isn't happening in Fresno. And so the volunteers keep on trucking along, you know, and to do that over 20 years is amazing. The other person who's out at the needle exchange is Dr. Mark Lasher, who has a bus from the 1960s, and he gives free medical care during that two-hour session. So people come in with things like abscesses, which are sort of deep skin infections that some IV drug users get as a result of impurities, either in the product that they're using or in the somehow in the sterilization procedures. Anyway, they get tremendous sort of under the skin and sometimes under the muscle infections that need to be lanced. And he does this with also with a volunteer crew of medical students. And it's, you know, it's really quite a beautiful thing that's happening there. There's a lot of human frailty and sadness and illness, and it's upsetting. But there also is this feeling that people are paying attention to each other and giving people each other the care that they need.
Again, the event tonight at Frank's Place at the Warner Center for the Performing Arts in downtown Fresno is presented by Zocalo Public Square. Are Valley communities giving up on government? Looking at homegrown solutions to community health problems. On the lineup will be Ray Leone of Valley Leap, the Green Riteros rideshare program that we just talked about, the Tulare County Food Bank's Sarah Ramirez, and Fresno State social work researcher Chris Clark. I will be moderating the discussion tonight for Zocalo Public Square. It is a free event, and we hope to have many listeners out there for that. Lisa Marganelli with Zocalo Public Square joining us today. Lisa, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more election analysis in a moment and a preview of this weekend's concert featuring the Youth Orchestra LA and Youth Orchestras of Fresno, both on one stage on one night in the Valley. That's coming up on Valley Edition.
FM 89, this is John. How can I help you?
Good evening. I'd like to know if my membership is still current.
I can help you with that. What's your name?
D-R-A-C-U-L-A. First name, Count, like Basie.
Ah, here it is. Oh, it appears your membership expired in July of 1732.
My membership is expired? That's chilling. I would like to renew.
Sustaining members are the lifeblood of Valley Public Radio. Join or renew today at kvpr.org.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. We continue our talk about the 2016 election, now looking at some important local races throughout the San Joaquin Valley. And joining us in our studio, we have Fresno State political scientist Jeff Cummins. Jeff, welcome.
Thank you, Joe.
I want to start out with one of the most high-profile races in the Valley, and one that's getting national attention, national money as well, and that's the 21st Congressional District, David Valadao versus Emilio Huerta. The last time we talked about it, Valadao had this huge cash advantage. Not much was happening on the Huerta side, but then some super PAC money has started to come in. What's going on in that race?
Well, I think as we get down to the to Election Day, a lot of these super PACs, the congressional campaign committees are starting to look at where can they target their resources, and the way that the presidential election is going, they're trying to tie as many candidates as they can to Trump, and they think that given the registration advantage for the Democrats in this district, that if they pump some more money in it and tie Valadao to Trump as much as possible, although the link in this case is weaker than it is in some of the other congressional races where the Republican candidate has explicitly endorsed Trump, that they think they can pick off a seat that they should have had several elections ago.
A Democratic-backed committee is running media ads in Fresno and Bakersfield Market saying that Valadao supports Trump. He officially has not endorsed the Republican nominee and has voiced criticism of him, but I guess there was some tape from over a year ago, back before when the debates were just on the Republican side were getting going, that Valadao mentioned something about Trump. He's been viewed as such a strong candidate. Does that still hold? Are Republicans, from what you can tell, who pay attention to these things, is this a district they're becoming a bit worried about, or are they still confident with his strengths in that district?
You know, I would say that the way that the presidential election, we have to turn back to its impact on these lower-level races, that these are races that we did not think were going to be that competitive maybe a month or two ago. And with the Trump effect, many of these, well, I shouldn't say many, but certainly more of these races are competitive than what we thought of, not just in this district, but across the country. We're seeing what used to be safer Republican seats turn into the kind of maybe lean Republican category and into the toss-up category. So it really shows the impact of the presidential candidates. And we know, going back, looking at research, we know that there's this coattail effect where these down-ballot races, Senate and in the House, are impacted by the presidential election. So whoever the winning candidate is, they tend to sweep in office with them a number of their co-partisans on the ballot.
With the Trump effect, we've talked about this issue that anti-Trump voters maybe will be more likely to go out to the polls. Is there a flip side of the Trump effect also, in that after these last few debates where Trump is talking about the election being quote-unquote rigged, I've heard some analysts say that's not a really wise move for him to make because it could depress his own voters' turnout in some cases. Is that another thing to watch in some of these cases?
I mean, I think that's a possibility. So if I guess the logic there is, it's almost another reason to think that your vote's not going to count in an election like this. I would probably say the other important factor that's going on in this race and other races throughout California, at least, is that the voter registration for Democrats has surged. And so we're seeing them increase their margin over the Republican voter registration. So you've got, you know, the two things. You've got increase in the number of Democratic voters, which helps the Democratic candidates. And then you also have this Trump effect to the extent that it suppresses Republican voters. And I think that's probably more, I think, impactful than, say, the anti-Trump effect, where you get these people who are just, they don't want to have anything to do with the presidential election. They may be a voter in the past, and they're not going to mark anything for the presidential ballot and maybe the rest. But it's really hard to parse out what those offsetting effects are.
Up in the northern part of our listening area, Congressman Jeff Denham, also a Republican, he has endorsed Trump and also is they're seeing money coming in from both sides. And when money comes in, we know that means the race is becoming competitive. Is that seat perhaps even more in danger for California Republicans?
Yeah, I mean, I would say so. And especially the fact that it's not a real strong, certainly not a real strong Republican district. And the fact that you can explicitly tie Denham to Trump, I think, makes it a lot easier to make the argument that Denham is marching in step with Trump. And you can certainly run a lot of television advertisements around that.
I want to get a little more hyper-local in a bit, but there's a Senate race going on in California that almost no one is talking about. Are you surprised? Is it just the mix of candidates that we have here in this one? And I should say, for people who don't know, because it's talked about so little, Loretta Sanchez and current California Attorney General Kamala Harris, both Democrats, in the new top two system that California has. What does this say about that? Are you surprised? And what does it say about the top two system?
I guess it's surprising only because we haven't had a Senate race here in California in several decades. So we kind of don't know how these Senate races go because it's been so long since we've had one. But I think, yeah, it's definitely operating below the public's radar. And I would say that part of that has to do with the fact that most polls, there's a few exceptions out there that show that Harris has such a strong advantage in the race. You also have somewhat of a coronation by the Democratic Party as well.
Loretta, could that backfire on the party? Maybe not so much in this case, but is that something that sometimes can backfire?
I mean, it can be if you have a candidate with some skeletons in their closet. But so far, we haven't had any October surprises in that race. And Sanchez really hasn't done much that, you know, we've seen to close the gap. So, you know, if you're the Harris, if you're Kamala Harris and her campaign, you're looking to keep doing the same, which is keep this kind of low key, kind of run almost an incumbent strategy where if you're out ahead by a lot, you don't want to bring a lot of attention to this race. You don't want to change the status quo much. And I think that's what's going on here.
Let's turn to the Fresno mayor's race now. We heard Lee Brand earlier in our program today. Last week it was Henry Perea. This is a close race, but looking back on it so far, we had this water thing that kind of blew up over the summer, and there's some other discussion about leadership and how kind of leader are we going to be, but compare this to Mayor Swearingen's campaign, both in 2008 and then a re-election bid, which was not much of a campaign, but her ongoing rhetoric. She was all about, I've got this vision for Fresno. Are you surprised that we didn't see more these candidates articulate more of a bold vision for the city or some sort of major change? It seemed like there wasn't a lot of back and forth on those things, or am I wrong on that?
Well, I mean, I think I would probably agree that I don't know that, you know, actually Hillary Clinton gets this criticism too, is there's no real theme to the campaign that's kind of organizing the effort behind either of the campaigns. I think Perea has taken the strategy that he wants to try and hammer Brand on the water issue. Just got a mailer that contrasted how long it took Brand to respond to the water problem, and on day one that Perea is going to get in there and essentially solve the problem, which, you know, it's not going to happen very quickly at all. And so I think it just turns on these other negatives that you can try and point out on the other candidate. You can go back and look at their records on the county board of supervisors and the city council and try and poke holes. But I think I would agree that neither one has set out a clear vision of what Fresno is going to look like at the end of their administration.
How do you see this race right now? We've seen a few polls by ABC 30, which is probably the only media organization that's done polling that I know of in this race so far. There have been some internal campaign or campaign-affiliated polls that have been released. But those polls from Channel 30 seem to show it's pretty close, within the margin of error.
Yeah, I mean, they're all within the margin of error. So I think this one's going to go down to the wire. We don't really. I mentioned that we have these coattail effects in the congressional races, but we don't know how far that coattail goes down to these really local races. I think we have some evidence that it goes down to like state legislative elections, but I don't think it goes all the way down to the local races. So we don't have an idea if there will be this Trump effect, if they're going to be less likely to turn out, and those are voters that would more likely support Brand. You know, I would go back to what I said about the voter registration numbers that we've seen. The advantage seems to be going to Democrats, which would tend to favor Perea. And in addition to that, more of these Democratic voters are Latinos as well, which would, again, favor Perea. But it's, you know, I don't think we can really predict what the outcome is. Just going to be a close race.
Measure X, this is the bond measure that Fresno Unified is putting on the table. They finally came out with how they're going to spend that money after quite a bit of concern. Is this a referendum on Michael Hansen and his leadership of the district, and likewise the school district seats, the two seats that are up on this ballot as well?
Yeah, no, I think so. I think it is a referendum. To be honest, I'm somewhat surprised that they decided to put this measure on the ballot, considering what they're going through.
With the ongoing FBI investigation.
Exactly.
The superintendent says there is no investigation. Where is it? What's come of it?
Yeah.
Well, sometimes these things take a while, but it is a source of much concern in the community.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, it's not unusual for these FBI investigations to operate below the radar. You know, essentially go silent for a long time and then emerge with some findings. And I'm not saying that I know what's going to happen in it, but this is pretty common. It's just surprising that when you have this investigation for how money was spent on a previous bond, that you have the confidence, I guess you would say, to go back to voters and ask for another huge chunk of money was somewhat surprising. So I would, you know, venture to guess that there are some voters out there that are not going to support the bond and some of the school board candidates because of this.
We also have a number of communities looking at taxes in some way related to public safety. Visalia is looking at a sales tax, also special taxes in Madera, Kings County. Parlier is talking about if they don't pass this special tax, they could even disband their police department, and Sheriff Mims and the Sheriff's Department would take over law enforcement services there. Do you think voters in Central California are perhaps becoming more willing, at least to entertain the idea of special taxes to fund public safety? Visalia, by the way, already has an existing special public safety tax on the books.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's that surprising that, you know, we see what we might assume are more conservative voters supporting taxes. I mean, the popular belief is that conservative voters are very anti-tax, but we've seen for years, and I've looked at the numbers on this, when you start looking at these local ballot measures to support things like public safety or school bonds, that they actually pass at a fairly high rate. It helps if you're doing one that only needs a majority vote. So when you start looking at special taxes where you're specifically allocating the revenue to one particular type of service, you typically need a two-thirds vote. Those tend to go down at a higher rate than those that just require the majority. But yeah, I would say that the passage rate of these local measures is fairly high, you know, I would put it in the 60% range, actually.
Well, we'll have to see how it all turns out. Again, Jeff Cummins, Fresno State political science professor, joining us today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Joe. Glad to be here.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. There's a very special event coming up Friday in Fresno, something that, in fact, I think probably hasn't happened before in Fresno's history when it comes to local musicians and young musicians specifically. The Youth Orchestras of Fresno performs in concert at the Soroyan Theater with the Youth Orchestras of Los Angeles, Youth and Yola. Friday, October 28th, here to tell us more is Julia Copeland of Youth Orchestras of Fresno. Julia, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me here.
Let's start out with exactly what's going on here, because as I said, I don't think this has ever happened before, at least to my knowledge. How did you go about bringing this concert together?
It was because we already knew the people at the Los Angeles Philharmonic, and in fact, our music director, Thomas Lowenheim, and I had appeared with some of the people from YOLA, their music director, Milano, and their education director, Gretchen Nielsen, and we had appeared on a panel together at a conference and hit it off very well. So when they were taking their 10th anniversary tour with this fabulous orchestra, they contacted us and wondered if they could get a trip to Fresno out of it. So we, of course, jumped at the chance. And these are, by the way, the YOLA, Youth Orchestra LA, these are the same people, the same kids that you might have seen if you were at the Super Bowl, watching the Super Bowl, or any part of the Super Bowl. They were playing at halftime with Coldplay.
Yeah, of course, that's one way that people know about this group. The youth component of the LA Philharmonic, that's a big priority of Maestro Gustavo Dudamel, of course, going back to his time in Venezuela, leading the youth orchestra there. That was a huge feather in his cap and really brought him to international prominence. How has that been so important with the LA Philharmonic's program?
Well, in fact, the fact that Dudamel was a product already of El Sistema, which has been in place in Venezuela since 1975, was the reason, really, that they created YOLA, because they needed to have something in place in Los Angeles that he could take over when he got there. I wouldn't say take over, but that would fill that spot somehow. And they were very devoted to that idea anyway, so it just worked out perfectly for them. So 10 years ago, they started their El Sistema-like program called YOLA.
And what is that program like for people who aren't familiar with how it works in Venezuela or how it works here in the States and Los Angeles? And is there anything like that here in the Valley?
Oh, these are great questions. Yes, we have such a program, but we would like it to be much, much bigger, which is why we would love everybody to come and see YOLA, hear YOLA, understand what they've done for the past 10 years in Los Angeles that is so impressive. So the project in Venezuela, as it began in 1975, was really born out of a need to work with the underserved communities, children who are living in severe poverty. And it just came about that a guy named Abreu discovered that having the kids trained as musicians on instruments and working together daily in youth orchestras seemed to just be the ticket, that the combination of the kind of mastery you get from learning, you know, an instrument, which is very difficult and requires a lot of focus, plus the working together, the collaboration of being in an ensemble, particularly in an orchestra, which requires an awful lot of agreement, like complete agreement at all times, that this somehow had a big effect on brains and also on character. So this idea has spread. It's been 40 years now, and it's been so successful. There are now 800,000 kids in youth orchestras in Venezuela, a very small country, more than are in sports, and that's a sports-mad country also.
Again, if you just joined us today, Julia Copeland with Youth Orchestras of Fresno with us on Valley Edition, talking about this concert coming up Friday, October 28th at the Soroyan Theater in Fresno, featuring Youth Orchestras of Fresno and also Youth Orchestras of L.A., program of the L.A. Philharmonic, a big deal. Are the students going to get a chance to interact with each other in any way?
Indeed, they are. What's really wonderful is that the Los Angeles Philharmonic people, as they proposed it from the beginning, always wanted our kids to play with theirs. So we actually are doing that. One of our orchestras is going to be performing, and then at the end there will be some mixing of the kids. So that'll be really nice. So both orchestras are playing different things. Also, as I mentioned earlier, you asked, do we have such a program here? We do. It's very small, and it's called Accent and Access. It's a violin program. We run it after school free also in West Fresno, and it's been extremely successful. But the question is, how can we make it larger? And we're just so excited to have Yola here to show us what one city has done to make an enormous program, making an enormous difference in the lives of young people.
When you start out with the students who come in a new academic year, it's relatively early in that academic season. Is it unusual to have a concert this early and to be on such a high-profile stage at this point?
Oh, yes. For us, that's a bit of, you know, that's a little bit of pressure. But our kids are, it's interesting, our kids are so up to everything. You know, it just really, we just say, here's what we expect. And they say, okay, you know, and they'll just do it. You'll see, you'll be impressed. We have wonderful kids. Every year we say, oh, this is the best ever. And of course, this is the best ever. And they're all fabulous. And they're all, you know, so dedicated. It's wonderful to see them in rehearsal. We invite anyone to come. We're on Sunday all afternoon and evening at Fresno State. Anyone's welcome to come to our rehearsals.
So. Now, you're called Youth Orchestras of Fresno, plural.
Because
there's more than one.
That's
now,
right.
How does that work, and what are we hearing on the concert Friday?
Okay, so we have three orchestras plus our after-school program. The three orchestras are really basically levels and sort of go by age. So naturally, the ones who were most likely to be able to have something ready by October, as you point out, in such a short time, were the most advanced orchestra, which is called the Youth Philharmonic. And those tend to be, they're probably ages 11 through 17, basically, is the age group there. So they're fabulous. But equally fabulous are the other two orchestras. We have the Symphony Orchestra, which is our intermediate group, also a full symphony orchestra with all the instruments, percussion, everything. And then our introductory orchestra is called the Chamber Orchestra. Used to be just strings, but we had so much desire from little wind players to come in that we also have now winds in that orchestra too. So they're all fabulous. Representatives from all the orchestras will be on hand on that night to play, so it won't just be one. Their program also involves a video that explains the history of Yola in Los Angeles. So this is not just a concert. This is really a way for us to learn about this project. And the reason we're so excited about it, we're excited for a number of reasons, but one of the reasons we are excited is that we see that this kind of program could be so incredibly helpful in this valley, in the Central Valley. And to get everyone to see what this could be. That's our dream, to have everyone come, everyone from the Valley actually be at this concert and see what they're doing and see the video and hear the kids and just really get a notion of what could be done.
Yeah, we all know the potential is here, and the potential is already being realized, at least in part, through the great students and work with the Youth Orchestras of Fresno, sharing the stage of the Soroyan Theater on Friday night with the Youth Orchestra LA. It's a program of the LA Philharmonic. The Youth Orchestra LA will be led by Juan Felipe Milano. Of course, Dr. Thomas Loewenheim of Fresno State, leading the Youth Orchestras of Fresno in that concert. Julia Copeland is the director of the program. She joins us today. Julia, if people want more information either about this concert or about your other programs for students, what should they do?
I think the best thing is to go to our website, www.youthorchestrasfresno.org. They can also call us, 275-6694. They can email us, anything they like. And the tickets to this, did we mention that everything is free? This is a free event. We do have ticketed seats so that we know how many people are coming, and you can reserve in advance if you want, but they are free, or you can just show up at the door on the night.
Again, it's Friday night at the Saroyan Theater, a free concert, two great youth orchestras on one stage. Julia, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Well, that does it for this special Valley Edition two-hour election preview show. I hope you enjoyed the program. As always, we want to know what you think. Send us an email. We are talk@kvpr.org, and on Twitter, we are @Valley Edition and @KVPR. And remember, you can find our podcast and audio archives on our website at kvpr.org, and also subscribe to our new outdoors podcast, Outdoorsy. You can find that on iTunes as well as kvpr.org. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Carrie Klein, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.